This is The Scoop, a weekly regional roundup of stories from remote radio stations in British Columbia. Each week, The Scoop features news created by fellow LJI journalists in the communities of Smithers, Prince George, Nanaimo, Burnaby, and the Comox Valley. LJI is the local journalism initiative, and it's how your best local news is funded on these participating stations. Now, let's see what's happening this week in BC.
Today on The Scoop, the Worker Solidarity Network hosted a workshop at SFU for students' labor rights. Danny Nesvarandi at CJSF in Burnaby has more. Spring is election season for student governments in Prince George, slightly today, with the College of New Caledonia's Student Union, the UNBC's Graduate Student Society, and Northern Undergraduate Student Society all casting ballots this week. Ian Gregg at CFIR Radio dives in. In Nanaimo, youth and hidden homelessness data is now being counted in the United Way's point-in-time count, Lauren McKenzie at CHLY reports. And in the Bulkley Valley, finding childcare in any small town can be difficult, but for one Smithers mother, the task of finding childcare became so overwhelming that she opened her own daycare. Pam Hassan at CCK News has that story. I'm Daniel Messick, and you're listening to The Scoop.
Reporting from Burnaby, BC, this is Danny Nesvarandi, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. On March 26th, a workshop on workplace rights was hosted at Simon Fraser University by the Worker Solidarity Network. This workshop was hosted in collaboration with the Simon Fraser Public Interest Research Group, SFU Labor Studies, and the Student Worker Center Initiative, which is something that is still currently being developed by SFU students. The Worker Solidarity Network is a labor advocacy group that provides educational resources and organizes campaigns for precarious and non-unionized workers throughout BC. CJSF attended the workshop, where the event's hosts Ismail Askin and Chris Castaños asked attendees to share their experiences of past employment and presented a dense package of facts regarding labor rights, everything from wage theft to community organizing around workplace rights. After the event, CJSF spoke with both Chris and Ismail and asked them why it was important for them to speak with students about labor rights in this context and how this event came to be in the first place.
So my name is Ismail Arishmael, and I am the Community Engagement and Campaign Coordinator with Worker Solidarity Network, as well as one of the legal advocates. So my role is to, engage community, join events, facilitate events, organize our various campaigns and plug community members into it, as well as supporting workers directly with their cases.
My name is Chris. I am the Membership Engagement Coordinator and a legal advocate with the Worker Solidarity Network. And what that looks like is just bringing members and people together who care about worker justice, finding ways for them to connect and share stories and hold events together, and also provide, as a legal advocate, be a resource for workers who are seeking justice in their workplace.
Yeah, so the event was actually coordinated mostly by the students here at SFU who reached out to us expressing that they were interested in hosting a workshop as part of a process they have to try and set up a student worker center, try to kick it off and involve more students at SFU in both labor struggles and in learning about their rights as workers. So on the Worker Solidarity Network front, we can actually take very little credit because this was almost entirely organized and planned by SFU students. And our role was to basically be present and support our work by providing this workshop.
I think there's the section in the act where we talk about, in the presentation, where we talk about who is represented or who is protected, especially in regards to migrant workers, international students. One thing we really like to emphasize is that all workers, regardless of status, are protected under the Employment Standards Act.
Yeah, so our website is very straightforward, just workersolidarity.ca. So if you even look up Worker Solidarity Network, BC, we're probably the top result on Google. And there, what students and workers can find is there is a form, a request support form that they can fill out where we'll just have a few questions around what their issue specifically is. If they fill out that form, then they will be able to book an appointment with us where, depending on what they're looking for, if you're a student and you're just looking for answers to some questions, then one of our legal advocates will get in touch with you, and that's all we'll do. We'll provide those answers. If you need further support, if you need perhaps someone to help you write a complaint to the Employment Standards Branch, or in some cases even represent you, we would also have that discussion, and we would never do anything without your explicit desire and consent. So if you're coming to us but you want to stay anonymous, you don't want to file a complaint, you just have questions, that's all we'll do. And then beyond that, on the About Us, you can find all of our emails, and you can get in touch with whoever you think is most appropriate. So if you have questions about becoming a member, you'll find Chris's email there. If you want to perhaps have us at an event or host an event together with us, you'll find my email there, and we are very friendly. You can just shoot us an email.
Despite the breadth of topics and issues that were discussed during the workshop, the Worker Solidarity Union was actually not able to get to every single point that they originally had planned for. According to Ismail and Chris, a part two of this workshop is currently in the works. This has been Danny Nezvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM.
This is Ian Gregg reporting for CIFA Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM. This initiative is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada through the Local Journalism Initiatives Program. Find our news stories online at frequencynews.ca or cfur.ca. Hello, Radioland. You are tuned in to CFUR 88.7 FM, and joining me in studio today is NUGS, or Northern Undergraduate Student Society President, Armin Jamwal. Thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy morning in this election period to have a little chat with us. I appreciate it. You are the outgoing president, which frees you up to speak during this election campaign. You just sent the message out to the student body that the voting period is open. So people are able to open up their inboxes right now, browse through the candidates, select the candidates they wish, and vote. Is that correct?
Oh, yes, that is correct.
Excellent.
And I would really like to share that this year's turnout was really great. We have 9 applications this year. We changed the structure in a way so that more applicants can apply for director and we can get more applicants. So, for example, you might have seen in the older years, like the last year, we used to have president, vice president, and then we had 4 directors. But this year, what we have done is we have changed that structure to only directors. And then president will be elected internally, which can be a president as well, chairperson as well, you can say, and which has led us to having 9 people apply for the director position. And
okay.
I think we can have those 6 people get ready up there. So, yeah.
Yeah, in the past, sometimes it has been difficult to recruit enough nominations to form student government, but it sounds like this solution is working well, hey?
Oh, yes. Yeah, pretty well. Yeah.
You served as president over a term where you had the former structure in place as president. It was a busy year, but how do you feel about it? How did the year go so far? How are you feeling as outgoing president?
I think this year was full of referendums, I will say.
Yeah.
Due to so many things going on around the world. Right now, we are having so much trouble with our health and dental plan as well. Our fees is increasing, and with that, health and dental fees is also increasing. So we had to do so many referendums about it. We just sent out the referendum last month. It was 55% yeses, but according to our NUGS bylaws, we have to get 66% yeses.
Oh, very close.
So that was really close, but it was heartbreaking as well. You just wanted that 10% and it didn't happen. But what we're trying to do is next year as well, we'll try next year as well. And maybe next month as well, you can expect that as well from us. It has been a great referendum year, and I'll pass this referendum things to the next board as well. There will be so many new referendums coming up because we just joined BCFS. And BCFS referendum will take place in this fall.
And that's BC Federation of Students?
Yes, that's BC Federation of Students.
What do you hope for the outcomes to be from joining BCFS?
I think as a single UNBC, you cannot advocate for so many things. So you need a community, a unity between a lot of universities to advocate for things. Because I have never seen UNBC advocate for things in my past years when I started my studies in UNBC. And I really tried for that because we are not advocating anywhere for our students. And students used to ask me, because I was part of NUGS for 4 years now, they used to ask me, like, our tuition is rising, like, what are you doing for it? And that question really stung me. So I tried my best this year to join BCFS. There was always a motion in our, whenever we do conduct our meetings, there was always a motion there, okay, do you want to join BCFS or CFS? So we studied about like how Canadian Federation of Students is working, which will be the best option for us. Is there either it's gonna be BCFS or it's gonna be CFS. And eventually we went for BCFS, as so many universities are part of it. That includes our nearby university, which is UBCO as well. So I heard so many good things about BCFS. So we started with the BCFS, and now we are a part of BCFS. And this year, I'm excited to say to my students that we advocated for your rights for increase in tuition fee. So that was done this January, and we were happy to advocate for students this year. Yeah.
And circling back a little bit to the health and dental plan that NUGS provides for students, the referendum was to increase the rates for the health and dental plan. Do you want to give us a little backgrounder on what NUGS is trying to achieve there? You know, why you're trying to raise those rates to meet the need?
I'm not sure like I can share enough information, but I'll let the people know. So for example, every year we have claims, right, for health and dental plan. Mm-hmm. And this year our claims were through the roofs. People were trying to get through the benefits and everything, and that was really good. I really love seeing people to use their benefits. I'm really excited for them. But due to increase in like inflation and everything, we really need it, because our plan, I think it cost around $290 or something. But like our plan is not up to the standards yet, because we are still paying out of our pockets, for example, from the NUGS revenue right now for students. So I really wanted, because we'll be depreciated in like 2 to 3 years, there will be no money left. So I'm trying to do this referendum to increase it by 20%. And it's not certain, like it's gonna be, it can be $10, it can be $20, but we are not certain. That's why we said, okay, like we want to increase by 20%, but there is not a perfect amount that we are gonna increase. So just wanted to get to know students, like what students thinks about increase of health and dental plan. We have never increased the fees in the last 10 years. Right. This was the first time we were trying to do it. And we can also look into the world economy right now. And I think it's really important that we do this referendum, that it has to pass so that students can enjoy those benefits. The other option was to take away a lot of plans which were students were using. For example, health and dental plan, we were thinking of removing it. But most students, they really like that plan. So I'm not sure like if we should take away that plan. And there's so many drugs that you can buy from these insurances, which are really beneficial for students. And I have seen the numbers. So many students apply for claims. So yes, that's what about this referendum that we were trying to do.
You were working to bring in the option of raising the fees 20% per year if that expense is needed, or if expenses...
Yes, because if we decrease all the benefits, then it's really hard for students. Like, why would you need that plan then?
Yeah.
If you're decreasing the benefits? The plan is there for the benefits, and I want to keep those benefits for the students. Yeah.
So that is something that the incoming council will have to address over the coming year, the 2026-27
year. Yes, for sure, yeah.
The next group of councillors, what do you think is on their agenda? What has kind of been emerging as like a primary issue for candidates to address? What's the student body looking at?
I think
right now?
That's what we have to see. I think the major issue is increasing tuition fee. I think they will be advocating for this next year as well. As soon as our referendum is passed for BCFS in the fall, we are ready to advocate for students, and we have the playground now to really, really advocate for students. So I have made that step this term. So I think hopefully they use it very well. And hopefully we pass that referendum for BCFS and we are on a good track.
That is outgoing Northern Undergraduate Student Society President Armin Jamwal. The NUGS election voting period occurs from Wednesday, March 25th through Friday, March 27th. Closing at 10 a.m., UMBC undergraduate students are invited to check their at UMBC emails for voting instructions. Votes are conducted directly through that email account. Then, on Friday the 27th, in the NUSC event space in UMBC's Building 6 from 11 a.m. to 1:30 p.m., there's a social opportunity where students can meet the candidates and get a free hot dog, a beverage, and some popcorn for the Hot Diggity Dog Day. Some games will be set up like cornhole, so you can challenge your newly elected representatives to a match if you choose. This is Ian Gregg reporting for CIFA Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM.
This is a Sichuan News Update. Once again, the numbers of those living unhoused in Nanaimo remains high, as United Way BC released the latest numbers for the 2025 point-in-time count. Over a 24-hour period on December 3, 2025, 577 people were found to be without stable housing. Along with the high numbers of those living on the streets, Naomi Woodland, Director of Housing Initiatives for United Way BC, says the count reveals the depths of hidden homelessness throughout the city. One key difference, Woodland says, is that this is the first accounting of people living in spaces like an emergency shelter, transitioning home, or a car. In years previously, they were only counting those unsheltered in a public space or an encampment.
And so that piece around people living in vehicles, couch surfing, staying with relatives, you know, they might have somewhere that's got a roof over it, but it's not a permanent, long-term, sustainable place for somebody to stay. And so that's what hidden homelessness is.
The 2025 PIC count found 31% of those surveyed living in a type of homeless shelter, 9% living in a vehicle, and 7% living in transitional housing. The remaining 51% were found living in an encampment or an unsheltered public space. While the count normally happens every 2 years, Woodland explains that as they are funded by the Government of Canada, the government has asked them to run enumeration counts as a way to check in on past year's numbers. An enumeration count works the same way as a regular count, but has a short survey for community members and collects less data from participants. For the first time, they also counted youth, people 24 years old and under, that were identified as unhoused. In the count, they identified 54 homeless youth with hidden or informal arrangements, such as staying at a hotel or motel, as their most common form of shelter. Factoring hidden homelessness and youth into the count, Woodland says was driven by community partners, such as the City of Nanaimo, Sinaimuk First Nations, and other local nonprofit organizations.
And it was actually at the direction of those partners that we started to include these other areas of data that, honestly, most of those operators have known that that's a critical part of our understanding of homelessness locally, but it hasn't quite made it to those official survey points or data points. So it was community driven.
They say this is something they'll continue to survey during all future PIC counts. The 2025 numbers of 577 people found unhoused is a decrease from 2024, which found 621 people unhoused. But Woodland says this year's numbers should be taken as a bare minimum for the number of those living unhoused in the city, and that the true scale of homelessness is still very high.
This is a 24-hour period. It depends on who shows up on the day, who we can find, who's willing to kind of participate. And so all of those things are massive variables that makes a point-in-time count. It's useful as a kind of snapshot, but is it an actual real count of every single person that's experiencing homelessness within a community? Not necessarily.
Woodland says homelessness is a complex social issue. And since the COVID-19 pandemic, they have seen an explosion in the number of people experiencing housing precarity.
And ask anybody that's earning a minimum wage or a low income or even middle income folks, you know, the cost of living and the cost of housing has just gone up exponentially. And the statistics across Canada show that a significant number of families are two or three paychecks away from insecure housing. So I think I would just ask the community of Nanaimo to really consider that this could happen to anybody at any point in time. And I think we'd all want to make sure that there was a really solid safety net to help any of us or our friends and family if we found ourselves in those situations. And we are quite challenged with empathy right now because there are so many things happening in so many corners of the world. But really on our doorstep, there are lots of folks that need support and help, and anything we can do to support our own community is well received.
They say that people tend to look at the overall number of those unhoused. And while the 577 people counted is lower than the previous year, the need of support is not. The next point in time count is set to be conducted later this fall. For C2N News, this is Laura McKenzie.
This is CICK News. In Northern BC, finding childcare can shape everything, from whether parents return to work or whether families can afford to work at all. For one local provider, that reality became impossible to ignore. After struggling to secure care for her own child, town councillor Genevieve Patterson opened a small home-based center driven by what she describes as fear, not opportunity. Across BC, the province's promise of a $10 a day childcare was meant to ease that pressure. But advocates with the Coalition of Childcare Advocates of BC say the system is showing cracks, especially in rural and northern communities.
My name is Genevieve Patterson, and I'm a councillor with the town of Smithers and a small business owner.
Can you tell me what brought you to the decision to actually open up your own childcare facility?
When you have a baby, everybody says, oh, it's the most exciting time in your life. I would say I cried a lot during that time, and not just from the surge of hormones, but this fear of not knowing, how are we going to be able to afford to live, to pay the rent, to feed our children? Like, these are the same conversations I was having with other families. If we can't go back to work, it was scary. I honestly cannot even describe the fear. And I didn't want to sit and wait for someone to come in and save me. Like, that sort of fear just drove me to say, I don't really have a choice.
Yeah. Affordability benchmarks are the backbone of how childcare fees are set in BC. But they're not based on what it actually costs to run a childcare center. Instead, they're based on what most providers are already charging in a region. The province sets a maximum fee, called a benchmark, and if providers charge above that, they can't access government funding to reduce parent fees. That funding, through the CCFRI, or Child Care Fee Reduction Initiative, is what brings costs down for families, sometimes by hundreds of dollars a month. But to qualify, providers have to keep their fees at or below the benchmark and meet a range of administrative requirements. The catch? In regions where fees have historically been lower, like northern communities, the benchmarks are also lower. So providers say that that can leave them trying to deliver quality care at rates that really don't reflect higher operating costs, staffing shortages, or inflation. So while the system is designed to make childcare more affordable for families, some say it doesn't always work for the people providing it.
You have these affordability benchmarks that you charge families in order to be able to cover your operating costs and provide quality childcare. Then you apply to the provincial government to receive various levels of funding, ECE wage enhancement, or operating costs. It's a sort of like an administrative transactional approach that happens between the province and you as a provider to be able to offer subsidized or affordable childcare to families. But a lot of the feedback that I've heard from people who I've asked for feedback as I launch into this initiative, they talk about that administrative burden doesn't cover their cost and their time. And it also takes away from their ability to provide quality care to the children because they're so head down then focused on this management of administrivia of all these various funding programs.
I'm Sharon Gregson. I'm the provincial spokesperson for the $10 a day childcare campaign, and I work with the Coalition of Childcare Advocates of BC.
The most recent 2026 provincial budget showed a $330 million addition over the next 3 years for the $10 a day childcare program.
Unfortunately, government got off track on implementing a quality $10 a day childcare system. So they created inequities by only having 10% of childcare be operating as a 10-a-day site. And they started to underfund those sites because they weren't investing appropriately in early childhood educators. So not enough money for decent wages for early childhood educators. And they weren't expanding quickly enough. So still long waiting lists. and an administrative overburden for operators.
And you also advocate for a more publicly funded system, but many childcare spaces are privately operated. So what role do you see for private providers, and do you think that there's a risk that they would be pushed out?
In the province right now, there's about 170,000 licensed childcare spaces, and all but about 5,000 of them take public money for operating.
So the province uses standardized funding benchmarks to ensure fairness across regions for providers and families. So for northern operators, how do you address concerns when you hear from them about inequity or setting precedents for other regions?
There are inequities right across the province, unfortunately. And every region has some specific challenges. But you're right that in the north, only 1 in 6 childcare spaces are operating as 10 a day. And there are additional challenges in the north that we hear about, particularly around transportation, around heating costs, around being able to attract qualified ECEs into mm-hmm. programs, being able to expand, particularly for infant, toddler, and school-age childcare. There aren't any regions that have sufficient numbers of qualified educators. And in one of the agreements that the BC government signed with the federal government, they committed to develop and implement a wage grid for early childhood educators. And our latest research shows that wage grid for post-secondary educated early childhood educators should be between $35 and $45 an hour. And yet the median wage for ECEs in the province is only $30 an hour, which means, of course, that half the ECEs in the province are earning less than $30 an hour, which is why we still have a recruitment and retention issue. So government needs to invite all existing childcare programs to be part of the 10-a-day system so that all families have got affordable fees. And they need to make sure that they're funding programs to ensure that operators can provide quality for children and fair wages for ECEs through the wage grid. And they need to expand to create more spaces working with school districts and municipalities.
As Sharon said, she understands that the government has a lot of work to do, but families across BC are counting on them to get it right. The $10 a day childcare program is in the right direction, and Sharon says that the coalition will keep holding government accountable to make sure that it delivers for children, families, and the early childhood educators who make it all possible.
My name is Shalana Schrader. I am an early childhood educator with a Strong Start program in Chetwynd, and I also work with the Coalition of Childcare Advocates of BC as a community outreach post. And my family made too much to meet any of the fee reduction, but it was more than 10 a day. So I had to leave my part-time position, and I paid about $1,000 a month for that. When that program closed down, then I applied for 10 a day with the local Y in Chetwynd, and I was lucky to make it off the waiting list after a few months, and my son attended 10 a day, which was a game changer for our family. And what I hear from a lot of parents that come is that they are searching for childcare. And in Chetwynd, we have two centers that offer licensed care. And the one is 16 spaces, I believe, and the other one is 25 spaces. And that's for the 30-month to 5-year-olds. Then there's one infant and toddler center, and I believe it is 12 spaces, but it might be 15. And that's all that we have in the entire community. So a lot of people are still seeking childcare. And so they'll use Strong Start as connections with other families so that they can do private, unlicensed childcare. Being an ECE, it takes a large part of your life. And so it does need to be a career. It isn't just a job, right? When I landed in early childhood education over 12 years ago, I knew I was exactly where I needed to be.
In northern communities where options are fewer and pressures are higher, that imbalance is becoming harder to sustain. As governments revisit childcare policy, providers like Patterson are left asking the simple question: if affordable childcare is essential, who is making it possible and at what cost? I want to thank Councillor Genevieve Patterson, Shalana Schrader, and Sharon Gregson, all for taking the time to speak with me about this very important issue of childcare in the North. That's it for this week's Scoop. Catch us next week, Thursdays at 12 p.m. in Smithers, Thursdays at 4 p.m. in Burnaby, Fridays at 8 a.m. in Nanaimo, and weekdays at 7:30 in Prince George. The Scoop was made possible by funding from the Canadian government and the Local Journalism Initiative, a Community Radio Fund of Canada initiative.